Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, July 12, 2023 on 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. I'm coming to you live from beautiful, rainy Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprouts. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So the first thing I wanted to talk about, I want to remind you, it's been really hot. I want you to make sure to hydrate, to drink lots of water. If you're outside and you're really hot and you're starting to not feel well, it's time to get in the shade or get somewhere where it's cool or get underwater. And remember to drink lots of water, and you should be drinking lots of water all day. You can drink relatively diluted items. I wouldn't drink anything with a lot of sugar in it, but something that's diluted like seltzer water or fizzy water with lemon or electrolyte drink that's not too sweet and sugary, that you just kind of need it for the electrolytes, the minerals, the potassium, magnesium, and calcium will help to draw the water, and salt will help to draw the water faster into your system. So hydrating well is extremely important right now. And don't be a hero. Don't feel like you have to stay out in the heat doing whatever it is you're doing in the heat for a long time, whether it's sunbathing or exercising or working on your yard. Just be extra careful out there. Right now we're having a lot of rain, and I'm waiting for this rain to kind of ease up a little bit. I'm hearing that it's going to, by the time this show is done live, it'll probably have calmed down. So some of you are listening today, and depending where you are, it may be raining a lot, depending on what part of the state you're in or what part of the country you're in, wherever you're listening. Last week, I promised you that we were going to talk about how to evaluate chest pain. So when you get chest pain can be really scary, and it can be nothing, and it can be something. And it doesn't always signal a heart attack. But if you go to the ER with chest pain, that's the first thing that ER providers are going to screen you for. It's the most life-threatening thing. And they may also check for life-threatening lung conditions, like blood clots in your lungs or whether your lung has collapsed. When you get to the ER, if they're concerned that you're having a heart attack, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to run an EKG. A regular EKG is where they lay you down and they attach electrodes to your chest, and then they look for abnormalities in your heart rhythm. If they see something abnormal right away, they may start treating you as though you're having a heart attack. If they don't see that, they're going to continue on to do the other items. They're going to wind up doing blood tests. And if they're doing blood tests to see if you're having a heart attack, among the tests they'll do is lactate dehydrogenase, and they'll do troponin. And if those things are elevated, then again, they're going to start treating you as if you're having a heart attack. Those are the proteins that you might see. They might also do a chest x-ray, and a chest x-ray will show what condition the lungs are in and also the size and shape of the heart and the major blood vessels. And so if you have a chest x-ray, it can show whether you have a blood clot, it can show whether you have a collapsed lung, it can show whether you have pneumonia or even a tumor or something like that, although that wouldn't necessarily cause acute chest pain. But it might. You could also have a CAT scan, computerized tomography. So a CAT scan is that's where they have you lie down and you go through the ring. What they're doing when you go through the ring, they're putting you through an x-ray, and the x-ray is very interesting. It as you're traversing through the tube, it's taking x-ray pictures of you in slices as you go through. So it's taking pictures of you at different levels. So it gives you more information than just a flat x-ray. A flat x-ray just takes one picture, whereas a CAT scan takes multiple pictures in sequence along the length of your body or along your body in slices. It's caudocranial, it's called. The caudum is your tail, and the cranium is, of course, is your head. So it slices this way. If you're watching Facebook Live or Instagram Live, I'm making slices through the center of my body, going from front to back through my head with my hand. So that's what a tomogram does. If they're concerned, then you might come back for follow-up testing. If it's not super acute, then they're going to have you do follow-up testing. If they're concerned that you still might be having blockages in your arteries, they're going to keep you, and they're going to keep you overnight for observation, and then you're probably going to get some other testing. So they might do an echocardiogram. And an echocardiogram is where they bounce sound waves off your heart, and they look at a picture of your heart, and they can see how the blood is flowing through your heart. They can tell the ejection fraction, which is the amount of blood that is being pumped out of your heart percentage-wise. And did you know the a normal ejection fraction is between 65 and 75%? It's not 100%. It's not even really close to 100%. It's normal for you to have some residual blood in your left ventricle. So 65 to 75% is perfect. That's just great. That's a healthy heart. So the echocardiogram shows that, and the echocardiogram will also show what's going on with your heart valves. If the heart valves are opening and closing the way that they're supposed to, if the leaflets of the valves are thickened, if there's calcifications on them, if they're stenotic, that means they're not opening well and they're narrowed, or if there's regurgitation, that means so for example, you have the mitral valve. The mitral valve is the opening between the left atrium and the left ventricle. And it opens up, and it's the leaflet's supposed to open downward towards the left ventricle. And if they're a little floppy, they're going to flop some blood back into the atrium. The blood is supposed to flow from atrium to ventricle. And if some blood flows back into the atrium, that's called regurgitation. When your valve isn't functioning 100%, you're going to have some regurg. You also get a little bit of regurgitation as you get older. I had an echocardiogram years ago, and they told me I had a little bit of trace tricuspid regurgitation. The tricuspid valve is the valve between the right atrium and the right ventricle. And I had a trace amount of that, and they said that's fine. As you get older, that's fine. If it's excessive, it means there could be something wrong with the valve, and your heart is not functioning the way that it's supposed to. All right, so they also might do different kinds of CAT scans. You would usually, before you have a CAT scan with angiographic dye, you're probably going to have a stress test. If you can get on the, for a stress test, what a stress test is where they hook you up to electrodes once again, because they're doing an electrocardiogram. And then they either have you walk on a treadmill. Sometimes they might have you ride a stationary bike. Usually they have you walking on a treadmill. If you can't do exercise for some reason, so say you have joint problems, or they're concerned that you're not going to be able to exercise to a degree to stress your heart enough so that they can see a change in your electrocardiogram, then they're going to do probably a Lexis scan. A Lexis scan is where they inject a radioisotope into your system, and that stresses your, they give you a drug to stress your heart, and then they inject a radioisotope, and that changes how your heart functions. It increases your heart rate, and it stresses your heart as though you were exercising. And they see, once again, they see if there are changes in your electrocardiogram. And if there are changes, they'll stop the test, and then they're going to go on to do the CAT scan with the angiogram. They'll give you an angiogram where they inject angiographic dye into your artery, into your bloodstream. And then it'll get into your arteries, and then that's where they look for blockages in your in the arteries to your heart. And if they find them, it depends how severe they are. Either you're going, if they're not very severe, you might be prescribed cholesterol-lowering medications. If they're severe, you're not going home. You're going to stay, and you're going to either get a stent, and you're going to be either offered stents, and you're going to be offered bypass graft surgery. And these are big deal. Stents are not as big a deal as bypass graft surgeries. And there's some controversy as to which one is more effective. The thinking is that when you have bypass graft surgery, it's more permanent and effective for longer because you're replacing the damaged arteries, and you usually replace them with arteries from other parts of your body that don't tend to collect plaque as much. So if you're given a stent, there are those who think that stents don't last as long because stents can fill up. Stents where they clean out some of the plaque that's in your arteries, and then they put tubing in to help keep those arteries open, and then you wind up taking medication to help them not to fill up again. Usually medication to help prevent blood clots, and also cholesterol-lowering medication. That's the thing. If you have chest pain and you go to the ER and it's discovered that you have serious atherosclerotic plaque, you are going to be offered the opportunity to not go home until that is resolved. And it might turn into coronary artery bypass graft. That's just how it goes. And so when they do the when they do the angiogram, it's called coronary catheterization because they put the scope in through an artery, usually in your femoral artery, so they because they, you have access to it. It's easy to get into your femoral artery. It's very accessible in your groin, and then they put the that they can scope the camera through there all the way up to your coronary arteries, and they can look around and look at your coronary arteries. It's amazing how that they can do this.
This sounds all very familiar to me.
I know. It's because you went through all this. Yes. So if it turns out that you have atherosclerosis that causes pain, but it's not enough to do surgery, you might be offered nitroglycerin. And nitroglycerin, which is usually taken under the tongue, nitroglycerin produces nitric oxide, and nitric oxide relaxes arteries. It makes arteries open up so that they're not so narrow. If you might be given aspirin, which is just a simple antiplatelet aggregator, makes it so platelets don't stick together, and it reduces the level of clots that you might have. You might also get other drugs that are not aspirin. So it could be, and there are other antiplatelet aggregators like clopidogrel or drugs that are 10A inhibitors like apixaban or rivaroxaban. You might also be offered warfarin. I don't see people offered warfarin as often because of the side effects. People don't feel well when they take warfarin. And the other thing is that warfarin is vitamin K dependent, and you have to be careful how much vitamin K containing foods you eat because it can block the effects of the warfarin. So you can't eat as much leafy greens as you might, or you just have to watch how much you eat, and you have to eat them at an even level, and then they give you a dose of warfarin based on how much greens you're eating, and they want to see your INR. The INR is a test for how fast you're clotting. It's one of the parameters for how fast you're clotting, and they want to see the INR rise between 2 and 3, and that's a level of the thinness of your blood. So they also, if they decide that your chest pain is actually heartburn, that you have gastroesophageal reflux, a healthcare provider might give you just acid blockers to take, and you could go to your friendly local naturopath, and we can talk to you about how to reduce acid reflux and help to soften and heal your esophagus and heal your stomach. There are herbs that you can take, and then diet changes you can do, and then stress reduction that you can do. Also, it could be that your chest pain is simply stress. Like if they rule everything else out, that you ultimately are found not to have reflux and your heart is okay and your lungs are okay and you're just having chest pain and they don't know what else it is, then they're going to say, okay, it's stress. But you shouldn't just be dismissed for having stress, because when you're having chest pain that is from stress, you're having musculoskeletal pain because you're tightening up and you're probably not breathing as well as you might. So stress reduction techniques can be helpful for that. And good old stress can give you chest pain because it can give you pain anywhere in your body, especially back pain. But the accessory muscles of breathing are going to be more likely to be affected. And your, muscles in your core, because that's where you tend to tense up and hold if you're not breathing properly. And if you're actually having panic attacks to the point where you're going to the ER for panic attacks, you might be offered antidepressants. So, yes, what were you going
to
say?
Well, I actually went to the emergency room a number of years ago with chest pain. Yeah. And when I went in, they checked me all out and everything was fine. And they concluded that, because I was still having the chest pain, I pulled a muscle.
Right.
In my chest.
Yes.
And it hurt a lot.
Right.
And that's what it was. So it can be as little as that.
It can be as
simple
as that.
But you should definitely get it checked out.
You still get it checked out because time is tissue. That's the saying, time is tissue. The faster you get to the ER, the faster they can stop whatever process is happening that is hurting you. and you can save tissue. You can keep more of your heart muscle if they can stop the process, if they can open up the blood vessels, if they can anticoagulate you, if they can do whatever it is they need to do to save that heart muscle if indeed you're having a heart attack. That's why if you're having chest pain and it just won't go away, it's a good idea to go to the ER. And don't worry, nobody's going to say to you, you didn't really need to come here. Nobody's ever going to say that to you. They're going to work you up and they're going to do all their due diligence and figure things out. And nobody's going to say you shouldn't have come here. They're going to tell you, okay, thank goodness you're okay. And here's your follow-up that you're going to have to go to this practitioner, and this practitioner. That's usually what happens afterwards. And so when you're in the ER, that you might, if you have atherosclerosis, you're probably going to be offered a stent or a coronary artery bypass graft. If your chest pain could be a ruptured aorta. That's the other thing, that your aorta, which is the great vessel that comes out of your heart, the great artery that comes out of your heart. It's the first artery to leave your heart to carry blood to all the places in your body. It's kind of like the I-95 of your arteries. The corollary arteries that come off it, like the 295 and the 495 and the 195 and the 395.
These are East Coast terms.
Yes, yeah. They are. Yeah. It's true. If we were out west, we would be saying the I-5.
The I-5, right.
And the 205 and the 105 and the 405. I've been on the 205 and the 405 outside of Portland and the plane 5 back and forth to Seattle. Depending where you are in Portland, you might pick up the 205 for a ways. Then if you're down by my mom, then you take 75 and 275 anyway. So, so you may wind up having emergency repair surgery of some kind. And if you have a collapsed lung, you might have lung reinflation surgery. Chest pain, if you have severe chest pain, you should, like I said, don't waste any time because you're embarrassed. It might not be a heart attack. Even if there's another cause, you have to go right away. And it's probably a good idea not to go to urgent care. Just go right to the hospital, because if you're having chest pain and you go to urgent care, they don't have the means to treat you if it's a heart attack. So it's better to just go, because people go to the urgent care if they think it's not too bad. But if you think you might be having a heart attack or a stroke, it's better to go straight to the hospital because they can take care of you right away. You're going to explain your symptoms in detail. You're going to give a medical history. You want to make sure you tell them any medications you're already on. If you're on supplements, you want to tell them that too. And when you're there, you want to find out what the cause of your chest pain is, and they're gonna figure that out and work it all up, and they'll give you a final diagnosis or say, well, it's not this, this, and this, and then you have to go on to these other practitioners, and they're gonna offer you. They may offer you some treatments right away, and others they might send you off to your primary care or to a cardiologist or to a gastroenterologist, and they'll and at that point you're gonna get further recommendations. You want to find out, is there anything any restrictions that you need to follow when you get home, and just make sure you know what to do when you're leaving. And the doctor's going to ask you when your symptoms started and whether they've gotten worse over time. Is there radiation? Does it spread to other parts of your body? They're going to ask you to describe the quality of your pain. They're going to ask you if you're lightheaded or dizzy. Have you vomited? They're going to ask you if you already have high blood pressure and if you're on meds for it. And if you do or ever smoked, or if you use alcohol or caffeine and how much, and do you use any other drugs, or do you use illegal drugs, or are you on ADHD medication? ADHD medication can be amphetamines, and if you take too much of that, it can do things to your heart. So any medications at all that you are on, whether legal or illegal, whether prescribed or not, anything that you're putting in your body that could be changing your body, you need to tell them about that. So those are some things, those are caveats about chest pain. So as I said, the first thing they rule out is whether it's a cardiovascular cause. They want to know if your chest pain is being caused by a heart attack or some kind of a coronary artery blockage. And as we said, the coronary arteries are the arteries that feed the heart muscle wall. They need to not be blocked because they need to get blood flow and circulation to the heart muscle wall. The other very serious thing is a pulmonary embolism. They want to make sure that you don't have a blood clot in your lungs that's blocking your ability to breathe. So those are probably the first, for chest pain, those are the first two very concerning conditions. And that's why they're going to work you up for whether you're having a heart attack, and they're going to work you up whether you're having a pulmonary embolism, or if you have a collapsed lung. If you, there's something stopping you from breathing, that your lungs aren't functioning properly. And they'll give you, and they're going to give you chest x-rays, and if they think it's your lung, but it's not acutely serious, you might be sent to the pulmonologist afterwards. They might give you a CT scan. As we said, a CAT scan can show blood clots. It can show an aortic aneurysm that is that great artery that comes out of your left ventricle. This is my left ventricle over here, comes up and around, and it goes down into your aorta, into your abdomen. And people who get atherosclerosis can get calcification in the abdomen, and that can pooch out the aorta there. And if there's too much pressure on it, it can rupture. And that's very dangerous. And you can get chest pain from that. So that's something they're going to work you up for. So when you have chest pain and they're working you up for cardiovascular causes, they're likely going to do an ultrasound. They're going to do some kind of either a CAT scan or an ultrasound of your abdomen as well to make sure that you're not having anything going on with your aorta. And they're going to check if there's any other acute process with any abdominal organs. And the CAT scan can show that. And so if those acute causes are ruled out, you might be sent to the gastroenterologist to rule out GERD, a gastroesophageal reflux. If it's not extremely, if it's acute and it's gastroenterological, you could have an ulcer in your stomach, because that can hurt, and that can hurt a lot. If it's a bleeding ulcer, that can cause you a lot of pain. But if it's not extreme, then they're going to send you to the gastroenterologist, and the gastroenterologist, may just take a history and, look at your symptoms and give you medication for it, or a gastroenterologist may want you to have an endoscopy. Endoscopy is where they do a scope, they sedate you, and then they do a scope through your nose, down your esophagus, and then they take a look around inside your stomach, and they pass a camera through there, and they look all around at your stomach, take biopsies if needed, and then they pass it down through the duodenum, through the pyloric sphincter, which is the sphincter at the end of the stomach, the beginning of the small intestine. They pass it through there, and they look around at the first part of the small intestine, which is the duodenum, and they might take samples from there. And then if you're diagnosed with gastroesophageal reflux, you'll either get offered medication for that or lifestyle changes, or you can go see your friendly local naturopath who can help you with that sort of thing. And like I said, if all organic causes are ruled out, it could be musculoskeletal, like Ron said, it could be you pulled a muscle, and it could just be stress. And stress directly, when you feel pain in your chest from stress, it's technically muscles tightening up. Whether it's, it's usually muscles in your chest. It's not generally your heart muscle, it's generally skeletal muscles in your chest tightening up. Because if you're not feeling well, you tend to tighten up and tense up. If you're having chest pain, the first thing you do is you go to the ER, and preferably to the hospital, because if you're having a heart attack, the urgent care isn't going to be able to help you the way that the hospital can. We have an issue in Wyndham, we live in Mansfield, and our closest hospital is Wyndham Hospital. They do not have a cath lab. So if they think you're having a heart attack, you're probably going to be flown to Hartford. And I mean flown. You're going to get life-starred to Hartford, because they don't have the equipment at Wyndham Hospital to catheterize you if that's what you need. So you're going to be life-starred. That's interesting. So if we think we're having a heart attack, we're probably going to be flown to Hartford. Yeah. So, and that becomes an insurance nightmare. But if you want to live, don't worry about the insurance nightmare. They take payments If your insurance doesn't cover everything, they will take payments. They'll take payments for a long time. It is unfortunate that we live in a society where if you are not getting Medicare, you have to pay, and if you're not wealthy, you have to pay a lot of money to support your own health care. But it's not worth you dying. So, I mean, if you need an ambulance, if you need LifeStar, if you're having chest pain and you don't want to die, go to the hospital. It's okay. And figure out the finance of it later. It's not worth your life saying, I can't afford it, I'm not going to go. You shouldn't do that. So you heard that here. All right. So that's what to, so those are some ideas of what to do about chest pain. Now, let's talk a little bit about atherosclerosis and what it is. So what atherosclerosis is, it's athero means fattiness and sclerosis means hardening. So it's a fatty hardening inside your blood vessels, inside arteries. And generally atherosclerosis happens most often in the coronary arteries, which are the tiny skinny little arteries that feed your heart muscle wall. They don't only necessarily happen there. You can get atherosclerosis in the circle of Willis, which are the arteries that surround the base of your brain, and they feed oxygen to your brain. You can get atherosclerosis in your carotid arteries, which are the arteries alongside your neck, and they go upwards from your heart. And again, they feed the circle of Willis and then feed the rest of your brain. So that's a common place to get atherosclerosis. People also get atherosclerosis in, as I said, in their abdominal aorta, because, you know, that's a place where you have a lot of pressure going through. And if you have turbulent blood flow going through there, you get banging around the arteries and your body's going to want to repair that. So you tend to get atherosclerosis there. You can get you can get atherosclerosis in the femoral artery. Some people do that. And when they get that, they can get a condition called intermittent claudication, which is where you build up plaque in the femoral arteries. And when they open and close, they cause vasoconstriction and vasodilation. When they open back up, it tends to cause pain, and that's intermittent claudication. And that intermittent pain that you get in your legs from atherosclerosis in the femoral arteries. So fats and cholesterol and calcium can collect in your arteries and form plaque, and it makes it harder for blood to flow through your arteries. And it can, like I said, it can occur in any artery in your body. Then there's peripheral arterial disease. And people will get arterial blockages in arteries in their legs, for example. Frequently, that's where when people have peripheral arterial disease, that it tends to be in their legs. Because in your legs, you have a gravity problem. And when you have a shortage of blood and oxygen in the tissues of your body because of atherosclerosis, you can get pieces of plaque breaking off, blocking the arteries. And that's one of the things that can cause a heart attack and can cause a blood clot. And the atherosclerosis can travel into your lung and give you a pulmonary embolism. So atherosclerosis can lead to heart attacks, strokes, or heart failure. And it's a more common problem as people age. And there are things you can do about it. So symptoms of atherosclerosis generally don't show up until there's blockages. You can get chest pain or angina, like we talked about. You can get pain in your leg or arm or anywhere else where there's a blocked artery. You can get cramping in your buttocks when you walk, and that's going to be a sign of your intermittent claudication. You can also get shortness of breath. You can just be tired because you're not getting accurate circulation to various parts of your body where the arteries are supposed to go. And you can also have mental confusion if it's blocking the circulation to your brain. You can get loss of motor or sensory function on a side of your body if you're getting transient or acute blockages that are leading to transient ischemic attacks or strokes. And you can get weakness in your legs from poor circulation there. And so we talked about the symptoms of a heart attack, chest pain or discomfort. You could have pain in your shoulders, back, neck, arms, jaw, pain in your abdomen, shortness of breath, sweating, lightheadedness, a sense of impending doom, and nausea or vomiting. And stroke, you tend to get neurological symptoms because you're blocking arteries to your brain. So you can get weakness or numbness in your face or limbs. You can have trouble with speech or slurring of your speech, and also trouble understanding speech. You can have vision problems, loss of balance, and you can get a sudden, really severe headache. And if you think you're having either of these, like I said, 911, go right to the ER. There's thinking that this is controversial, but there is an idea that high cholesterol will lead to more atherosclerosis. If your cholesterol is extremely high, that's generally true. So if you have a total cholesterol unmedicated of over 300, and if you have an LDL over 200, you probably should be on some cholesterol-lowering medication. Because that's a sign of familial hypercholesterolemia, that you just make so much cholesterol that you're going to be more likely to get blockages in your arteries. And so there's so much cholesterol around that if there's any damage to any arterial wall, the cholesterol, calcium, and plaque is much more likely to gather there and block arteries. You can lower cholesterol to an extent by eating a healthy diet, and you can help your cholesterol to come down. The big thing that raises cholesterol, everybody thinks it's saturated fat. It's not so much saturated fat as it is starches and sugars. So excessive starches, especially refined starches and sugars, tend to raise cholesterol. Grains that have a lot of fiber in them, as long as they're eaten in moderation, don't raise cholesterol nearly as much as refined sugar. So if you're eating a lot of pasta and pastries, and you're doing that to the exclusion of fruits and vegetables, that can create more cholesterol. So eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, eating whole grains in moderation. Low-fat dairy products, that's with the idea that if you're a cholesterol hyperproducer, if you reduce the saturated fat from dairy, you may be able to lower your cholesterol as well. Poultry and fish, there's the idea that you don't eat the skin. I don't know if that's true because there's essential fatty acids in the skin that you can eat. Nuts and legumes, because they have alpha-linolenic acid, which does tend to lower cholesterol in them. And nuts and legumes have a lot of fiber. Well, the nuts have the alpha-linolenic acid. Nuts and legumes have a lot of fiber in them, which and fiber tends to sweep excess cholesterol out of your circulation, out of your digestive system. And vegetable oils like olive oil and avocado oil and grapeseed oil can be helpful. And there's a controversy about whether coconut oil can raise your cholesterol. I think the bottom line thinking is if you get virgin coconut oil, it doesn't raise your cholesterol. It actually can be helpful. And then in general, if you eat a lot of food and drink that has a lot of sugar in it, such as beverages that have a lot of sweetener in them, if you eat sweets, candies, desserts, and try to keep your sugar level to 6 teaspoons or 100 calories a day, that's just of the sugar. So if you're having a chocolate bar, not all of the calories are from sugar. And you have to look at that, how much, you know, how many calories from sugar is in your chocolate bar, and then keep your total down to 100 calories or less. So if you keep your sweets down, like your sweet foods to 100 calories or less a day, you're going to be doing pretty well. And that's for women. And for men, it's no more than 9 because, you know, they have somewhat higher metabolism because they have more testosterone and they have more muscle mass than we do in general. This is a generalization because you can have a woman who has more muscle mass than your average man, and you can have a man who doesn't have a lot of muscle mass. But in general, men have an edge when it comes to both testosterone and muscle mass. So the muscle mass increases their metabolism, so they can get away with eating a little bit more sugar in a day, which doesn't mean they should still eat a lot of sugar. So watch your salt. Some people have salt-sensitive hypertension. And so the thing is, hypertension, high blood pressure, can cause your... high blood pressure can cause you have turbulent blood flow in your arteries and can cause more atherosclerosis because your body's going to want to repair your arteries. So too much salt can raise your blood pressure if you're salt sensitive. If you have a little bit of good quality salt in the context of a really healthy diet where you're eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, you're eating your salads, you're eating your nuts and seeds, a little bit of salt is probably not going to hurt you. But if you're eating a lot of high salt processed foods to the exclusion of a lot of produce, that's going to be a problem, and that will tend to raise your blood pressure. It's not so much that salt will tend to raise your blood pressure, but if you drink a lot of water and you eat a lot of foods that have calcium and magnesium in them and calming minerals, a little bit of salt isn't going to make that much of a difference. And so you do want to avoid unhealthy fats like trans fats. So deep fried food is going to tend to have trans fats in them. And unsaturated fats are going to be better for you. Your olive oil, even if you saute in a little bit of virgin coconut oil. If you're deep frying foods, if you're making, you know, using a big pan of foods, of oil, and then you're frying something in it, and you're heating that oil up, you're going to get some trans fats there. And if you're going to the shack, or you're going to the restaurant and you're getting French fries, or you're getting, you know, fried calamari, things that are deep fried, you don't want to do that all the time, because the high heat, when you heat vegetable oils at high heat, they produce trans fats. Heating vegetables at very high heat, or heating vegetable oils at high heats will produce trans fats. And what a trans fat is, it's where basically the big pieces of the molecule are arranged diagonally across from each other. And that may not sound like it means much, but the thing is, in your body prefers cis fats, where the big pieces of the molecule are on the same side of the carbons as each other. So your cell membranes are covered in fats. They're covered in essential fatty acids, and they are cis fats. And so you want to be eating cis fats. If you eat a lot of trans fats, your cell membranes are going to be replaced with trans fats. And you need those cis fats there, because the cis fats are slippery and flexible, and they allow information, nutrition, and compounds to go in and out of the cells that need to. When you have trans fats are rigid and they don't allow things to pass in and out of the cell. So you're going to be, more deep fried stuff you eat, the more malnourished you're going to be, because your cells are going to be covered in these trans fats and they're not going to be able to get the nutrition that they need to get. So that's very important. So as you get older, your blood vessels have to work harder to pump and receive blood, and they may need more, because they're less resilient. They can get damaged more easily, so your body's going to want to go repair them. So you're more prone to atherosclerosis the older you get. If your doctor's concerned you have atherosclerosis, your doctor's going to check you for a weakened pulse. It's going to check you for aneurysms, like an aneurysm, as we talked about, in the abdominal aorta. Also, if you have slow wound healing, that can be because of restricted blood flow. They will also listen for bruits. A bruit is a French word that means a noise. And you can hear bruits in the carotid arteries if somebody has hardening of the arteries. If they have blockages in the carotid arteries, you can hear that whooshing sound in the carotid artery. So it's going to, instead of sounding just like a pulse, it's going to sound like boosh, boosh, boosh. I don't know if I've ever heard a carotid bruit, maybe once or twice. It's a little unusual. I think even if somebody does have blockages in their carotid arteries, you don't always hear the bruit. And of course, the cardiologist is going to listen to your heart to see if you have atypical sounds. And then to test for atherosclerosis, they look at your cholesterol levels. Like I said, they do an ultrasound. And to particular arteries, they might do an ultrasound on your abdominal aorta. They might do an ultrasound on your carotid arteries, because you can see those. You can also prepare... you can compare the blood pressure in all of your limbs, and if there are differences in the blood pressures of either arm or your legs, that could be that mean that there's blockages in any of those limbs. You might get an MRA, which is a magnetic resonance angiography, or a CTA, which is a computed tomography angiography, where they give you a dye and they look for blockages in the large arteries of your body. If you're in an emergency situation and you've gotten past the stress test and you failed the stress test, you're going to get an angiography. And they also can do an angiogram, which is an X-ray that's taken after your arteries are injected with the dye. And of course, you're going to get just a plain EKG, but plain EKG is going to happen early on. I mean, if you went to the ER with chest pain, you're going to have an EKG there. You might have another EKG. If you're already to the point where they're considering whether you have atherosclerosis, you're going to get a stress EKG, whether it's on a treadmill, a bicycle, or you get a pharmaceutical to increase the load on your heart to see if you have atherosclerosis there. And like I said, you might be getting a stress test. We already talked about that. So you treat atherosclerosis. You might treat it if somebody has atherosclerosis, but they're not to the point where they need life-saving surgery. They might be given cholesterol-lowering drugs like statins. They may be given some kind of a blood pressure-lowering med, and there are many kinds of blood pressure-lowering meds. There's angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors. There's angiotensin receptor antagonists. There's beta blockers, which slow the heart rate and calm the heart rate down. And you might also be given antiplatelet drugs like aspirin or, as I said, clopidogrel or Brilinta, which is ticagrelor, which is a similar and another antiplatelet aggregator. Or you might be given a 10A inhibitor like apixaban or rivaroxaban, or you might be given warfarin. And like I said, I don't see people coming in warfarin so much anymore because there's other things that warfarin just has so many more side effects and people feel better on the other medications. So, like if you need long-term anticoagulation therapy, you're probably going to be given apixaban or rivaroxaban. Hey, I think the sun's coming out. So
about that?
They often, if they can manage to give you just aspirin, they'll often give you a coated aspirin because the problem with aspirin is that when aspirin touches the surface of your digestive system, it causes bleeding because it's a great anticoagulant. So any platelets that are there, it's going to make them separate and it's going to cause some bleeding. That's just what it does. And so if you take a regular aspirin that's not coated and you don't crush it up, it's going to get into your stomach and it's going to cause some bleeding when it gets there. So if you take a coated aspirin, there's a little coating on it that is acid resistant. So it won't break open in your stomach. It'll break open in your intestines. And so it can't cause a stomach ulcer. I mean, theoretically, I would think it can still cause irritation. You know, it can cause antiplatelet aggregating once it opens up in the small intestine, which is why they don't always give aspirin. I think that's less likely to happen if you take your 10A inhibitors. But aspirin is so cheap and it's pretty effective. There are things that you can do if you have to take aspirin. In my opinion, if you're taking an aspirin and you're concerned about it bothering your stomach, you can take the aspirin. When you take the aspirin, you can swallow the aspirin with a mucilaginous tea like marshmallow root tea. And you can make a mixture of marshmallow root tea and ginger tea. And the ginger is anti-inflammatory and the marshmallow root is soothing. You could also swallow it with some aloe juice. And aloe juice is also soothing and anti-inflammatory and might protect your digestive system from the effects of the aspirin. You'll still get your anticoagulating effects because you're going to absorb it into your system, but you'll protect your digestive system from bleeding. So if you have to take a drug that bothers your stomach, there are herbs you can take that can help with that. And ginger is a great one. Aloe is a great one. Marshmallow root, slippery elm. Marshmallow root you would drink as tea. I like the idea of drinking a tea because the tea is going to go in. It's dissolved in water. The constituents are in water, so it's going to coat your whole digestive system as it goes in. You can take slippery elm. You can make into a tea. They sell slippery elm lozenges, and those are very convenient, and you can chew on those. And it's better if you do chew on them because it's going to coat your whole esophagus and your whole stomach on the way down. DGL is another one, deglycerizinated licorice. And it's deglycerizinated because you don't need the glycyrrhizin to improve the condition of your digestive system. So they take the glycyrrhizin out, and glycyrrhizin can increase your blood pressure. It's good for people with very low blood pressure and low blood sugar. But that's not most people in the United States. So that's why they make DGL, deglycerinated licorice. And you can take that along with your aspirin if you have to take it. And so it can be helpful if you have, you know, risk of clotting and atherosclerosis. Because in order to make an atherosclerotic plaque, you need cholesterol, calcium, and platelets. And if the platelets can't stick together, you're much less likely to get that atherosclerotic plaque. And if you don't have enough cholesterol around, you're not going to make that plaque either. They don't do things to stop the calcium, and they don't make you stop eating calcium-laden foods because calcium is maintained in a much more intense equilibrium, and you have to eat some calcium. Shouldn't eat excessive calcium, but you're going to get some calcium in your diet. And, you know, people who have reduced bone density take calcium as a supplement to help them build up their bones, but you don't take calcium blockers. When you're preventing atherosclerosis, you go from the other direction. You block the cholesterol and you block the activity of the platelets. That's just what you do. And that's probably enough to do that. There are updated guidelines recently on the use of aspirin, which you have to talk about with your doctor, because there are some concerns that aspirin is just more likely to give you a stroke and it would give you a hemorrhagic stroke, because if you have any breakages in the arteries in your brain, then if you have too much aspirin on board, your platelets can't stick together and block it up. So if you're taking, one of the things to do is if you are taking aspirin is to watch and see if you're getting more bruising, if you're getting more bruising that you're not really aware of, and if your bruising is healing, and if you're having a problem with that, then it's a good idea to talk to your doctor about that. Because you can do things like you can take the aspirin, which is going to thin your blood. And then on top of that, you can make sure you're getting a lot of things that strengthen your blood vessels. So the things that strengthen your blood vessels that you take naturally that what they do is they help with the integrity of the blood vessels, but they don't stop the aspirin from thinning your blood. They'll just make your blood vessels stronger. So things like vitamin C. Vitamin C is very important for the strength of collagen. It's one of the one of the components of collagen. And so you have collagen in all of your blood vessels. And that's why when you're vitamin C deficient, you bleed, because you don't make adequate collagen. When you have scurvy, you bleed. And so when you don't have adequate collagen, your blood vessels fall apart. It's one of the signs that your blood vessels are falling apart. So consuming adequate vitamin C, you could take vitamin C, or you could eat foods with vitamin C in them, like your citrus or your kiwi fruit or your berries or a lot of vegetables like peppers have vitamin C in them. So you make sure you're eating adequate amounts of those things. Beyond that, there are things with anthocyanins in them, and this is anthocyanin time of year. Anthocyanins are great for strengthening your blood vessels, so you're going to get those in hawthorn and hawthorn berry, which we already talked about a couple weeks ago. Blueberries are in season now here in Connecticut, so you can go blueberry picking now, and you can go blueberry picking. I just came back from New Jersey, so I brought back blueberries from New Jersey, because New Jersey grows a lot of blueberries. Blueberries grow in acidic soil. So they have the Pine Barrens in New Jersey, and that, in fact, is where they grow blueberries. There are big blueberry farms, and especially in Hamilton, New Jersey, great big blueberry farms there. Also cranberry bogs in the Pine Barrens. Where there are pine trees, there is acidic soil, because pine trees produce a lot of acids in their metabolism. So they put down acids into the soil, and then acid-loving plants grow there. And a big thing that loves acid is our blueberries, raspberries, blackberries, dewberries, huckleberries, all of your anthocyanin bearing berries like acidic soil. So we have a lot of pine trees in our backyard, and we have fields of wild raspberries back there. And we have a few huckleberry bushes. We used to have are there any blackberries going on?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're coming. They're coming real soon.
Blackberries are coming. The raspberries are still there.
Raspberries are still there.
Yes, and we have many raspberries growing in our backyard now, because we have a lot of pines. And in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey, they grow lots of blueberries, and there are cranberry bogs as well. I remember there was one year, I think it was 2019, I went and did the cranberry bog sentry. It was a bike ride for the Charles River Wheelmen. And I rode by cranberry bogs in that ride. And within the same week, I had been to New Jersey and I did a bike ride where I went by cranberry bogs in New Jersey. And Ocean Spray, you know, the cranberry company, has a presence. I was on the Cape last week and I went past Ocean Spray, the company. They have installations on the Cape. Cape has pine trees and therefore cranberries, and other parts of Massachusetts that are near the coastline have a lot of pine trees and therefore cranberry bogs, and some nice roads where there are cranberry bogs. And in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey, they also have cranberry bogs, and Ocean Spray is set up in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey too. And little cranberries.
Yeah.
Good. So cranberries, by the way, lots of anthocyanins. And so in fact, berries from the Heather family, the Ericaceae family. Hi, shout out to my friend Eric from Oregon. But the Ericaceae family is the Heather family, and the Heather family, remember the Heather is what grows in Wuthering Heights, in the where you saw Heathcliff shouting out to Catherine in the in Yorkshire. They have the Yorkshire Moors, where those are actual heather plants. That's the plant that's called heather. And that, of course, is in the Ericaceae family. But low-growing berries are all in the heather family. So your cranberries, there's Vaccinium ideus, which is in Newfoundland, they call them partridge berries. And down here, they're also known as lingonberries in other parts of the world and the country. When they grow them in the United States, I'm not sure what they call them, but they are lingonberries. It's Vaccinium vitis ideus. But in Newfoundland, they call them partridge berries. What's known as partridge berries in the United States is a different plant. And I think that's the same as what's known as squaw vine. It's or black haw. Well, anyway, it's a different plant. But anyway, what partridge berries are in Newfoundland is Vaccinium vitis ideus. And it's a wonderful plant. So you can get lingonberry. If you find lingonberry jam or lingonberry juice, you can get that. It's full of anthocyanins. Cranberries themselves are full of anthocyanins, also in the heather family. And then huckleberries, blueberries, also in the heather family, very dark berries, full of anthocyanins, really good for strengthening your blood vessels. And they're not going to thicken your blood. In fact, they probably have some compounds in them that will aid in the platelets staying apart. When you have foods with flavonoids in them, flavonoids tend to increase, they are antiplatelet aggregators. The only thing that in nature that seems to increase platelet aggregation is going to be your vitamin K. So when you're eating your leafy greens will increase clotting. Having said that, your leafy greens are also going to have vitamin C in them, and other compounds like magnesium has some antiplatelet aggregating properties. So you're not going to eat a bunch of kale and then start clotting all over the place. That's just not going to happen. It's only a concern if you're eating too much kale. If you increase your kale and you're taking a particular dose of warfarin and you overdo it, and then you're going to lower your INR, and your docs are going to be concerned that you're not meeting your INR level, that your blood is not thin enough. So anyway, so we talked about what happens if you have atherosclerosis. We talked about how you could get bypass surgery, and that's where they take away the blocked arteries, and they take veins or arteries from other parts of your body, and they are your new veins and arteries, and they hook them up. In Ron's case, he had his internal thoracic and his radial artery, they were turned into his new coronary arteries, and those arteries tend not to ever fill up. So he's probably good to go. He may be good to go for the rest of his life, which is kind of interesting. So,
Hopefully.
Yeah. They can do thrombolytic therapy, where they give you drugs to dissolve blood clots. The TPA, tissue plasminogen activator. You don't hear about that done very much anymore. And then there's angioplasty, where they do the catheterization and a balloon to expand the artery and then inserting a stent to keep it open. And then there's atherectomy. They can go in and actually remove plaque from the arteries using a catheter with a sharp blade. They just take the plaque out. And they can do endarterectomies, which involve surgically removing the fatty deposits from your arteries. So that's what they wind up doing. If you have a family history, you're more likely to have hardening of the arteries. If you don't exercise enough, why? Because when you exercise, you get coronary circulation, you get great artery flow, you raise your HDL, and the HDL will run around and pull cholesterol out of your arteries, take it back to your liver for use. And if you exercise a move it or lose it phenomenon, when your blood vessels in your heart are stronger, you're going to be less likely to have them. They're going to be well nourished and they're going to be less likely to get blocked and you have good blood flow through there. High blood pressure, of course, can cause turbulent blood flow, which can lead to repair and therefore blockages of the arteries. Smoking has all kinds of oxidative stress products in it, which will lead to hardening of the arteries. And then diabetes, because the problem with diabetes, if you have elevated blood sugar that can't get into your cells, your insulin is going to turn it into fats. And then you get triglycerides, which can be damaged and damage the inside of your blood vessels. And extra sugar in your body is going to be turned into fats. And one of those fats is cholesterol. And so you can get heart failures, heart attack, arrhythmias and strokes if you have coronary artery disease, if you have atherosclerosis. And so as we talked about that you can get peripheral artery disease, we also didn't talk about that you can get renal disease. You can get atherosclerosis in the renal arteries, the arteries to your kidneys, which can cause kidney failure. So eat a healthy diet. Avoid deep fried foods. Get at least 75 minutes of vigorous or 150 minutes of moderate exercise a week. Have fish a couple times a week. Don't smoke and don't breathe secondhand smoke. Maintaining a moderate weight that's healthy for you. Manage your stress, because remember, what does stress do? Cortisol runs around your body, puts sugar into your blood. So the cortisol breaks down tissue, which can lead to atherosclerosis. And then it also raises your blood sugar, and then it causes you to make more blood fats. And so treat your high blood pressure, your high cholesterol. Sleep apnea can also cause you to have atherosclerosis. And if you're overweight doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have atherosclerosis. It's really a genetic thing, but it makes you more predisposed to it. And of course, treat your diabetes. And hardening of the arteries supposedly can't be reversed, but treating the underlying cause can help slow down the process or prevent it from getting worse. So anyway, so that's what we talked about today. That was nice. So it's atherosclerosis. So we'll get on to spinal stenosis next week, which will be very, you know, and back stuff, because I have a sore back right now. Mm. Wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm going to the chiropractor later, which is great.
Good.
All right. So there's so much to discuss about cardiovascular disease, but I think we should move on to other things because there's so much else you can talk about and help. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.